Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight our special guest is Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt and a regular contributor to Huffington Post and a number of online magazines. And she's we've had her on a number of times, but her recent article coming out tomorrow is...
Let's
in Huffington Post, and she had one last week, which was quite good. But the one coming out tomorrow is the European Stabilization Mechanism, or How the Goldman
Vampire Squid Just Captured Europe. Well, they ate us, and we weren't enough.
We weren't enough, but they failed actually at eating us all up.
Well, that TARP bill didn't.
No. And then this one. Which is another one hopefully we can get to tonight.
All banks are not created equal. How the people can use public banks to supplant Wall Street greed, by Ellen Brown.
Right, and we'll read that in just a few minutes before we bring her up. And let's see. But between now and then, what I wanted to do is I wanted to... which one did you want? Which one was your...
The one on Israel. I showed it to you. Keep going back.
Who's up? On top?
Oh, you go too fast.
Okay.
And that one
I don't know where that is.
It's right here. Go back now. Keep going.
Right there. That's we can start with that one. It's kind of interesting.
Okay, this is West and Iran step closer to agreement. Israel worried. If next month, let's see what the main article is about here. Here we are. We'll go into that. It takes a minute to.
And this is through.
Bring it up. Oh, I don't know what the site is.
Roytov.com.
Istanbul conference ends in a positive tone. Yesterday, April 15, 2012, the Istanbul conference ended a surprise for all participants in a positive tone. The previous round of talks between Iran and the P5+1 took place in late January 2011 and ended in complete failure. But then European Union High Representative Catherine Ashton released a statement. We came without precondition and made every effort to secure agreement, she said. We had hoped to have a detailed and constructive discussion of those ideas, but it became clear that the Iranian side was not ready for this unless we agreed to preconditions relating to enrichment and sanctions. This time things were different. Both sides engaged in dialogue and decided on a meeting on May 23rd in Baghdad. These meetings are unusual in their level. P5+1 refers to the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, Russia, China, the United States, France, and Britain, plus Germany. They take place due to Western accusations that Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons. Israel, the only middle-aged state with an atomic arsenal, sees Iran's atomic plans as a threat to its existence and has threatened military action. Iran says its program is peaceful and has already clarified it will retaliate for any attack on it by closing the Hormuz Straits, a major oil shipping route. The United States and Israel have not ruled out military action to destroy Iran's nuclear sites. However, the USA recently made clear that there would be no attack before the presidential elections this November. This may have caused the change in the tone of the talks. The difference in the international treatment between Israel and Iran as a result of Iran being a signatory of the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. while Israel is one of four nuclear countries refusing to do so. The others are India, Pakistan, and North Korea. This allows the international community to watch over Iran's nuclear program, but not to do so in Israel. Instead of being sanctioned for this, Israel is allowed to persecute Iran. The Istanbul Conference is a quite formal conference in Helsinki. In the first week of April 2012, Jaakko Lahava, Finland's Undersecretary of State for Foreign Affairs, informally visited Jerusalem to discuss Israel's participation, while in January he met with Iran's Foreign Minister, Ali Akbar Sahli, and dealt with the same issue. Following its aggressive nuclear policies, Israel is trying to cancel or at least postpone the conference, which will center on the Middle East. The USA, Israel's closest ally, helped to postpone the conference from 2011 to December 2012. But the American administration has announced in its sports the actual date of the event. Given the circumstances, Israel is worried about all the statements pronounced by the participants of the Istanbul conference. They met in a constructive atmosphere, said Michael Mann, a spokesman for the EU foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, who is also chair of the Istanbul conference. We had a positive feeling that they did not want to engage. This time, Iranian chief nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili did not state preconditions to further advance the talks, as happened in 2011. We want now to move to a sustained process of serious dialogue where we can take urgent practical steps to build confidence and lead on to compliance by Iran with all its international obligations, Ashton said. The aim of P5+1 is to create the confidence in the exclusively peaceful nature of the Iranian nuclear program, Ashton said. Yet the international community doesn't request that from the most probable aggressor, namely Israel, since it is not a signatory to the treaty. This type of discriminatory treatment is what undermines the trust on international organizations run by Western states and their allies.
In March 2012, U.S. President Obama convinced Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at a summit in Washington to give diplomacy a chance. This change of American attitude was welcomed in Iran. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini greeted Obama's words that diplomacy, not war, are on the agenda by saying they were an exit from delusion. Afterwards, a statement hinting at a possible solution was issued. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said Iran would cap uranium enrichment at 20%, enough to drive a reactor that makes medical isotopes, but not refined enough for nuclear weapons. This may be the agreement to be achieved next month in Baghdad. Now that's pretty damn reasonable.
Yeah, this is kind of a long article.
But anyway, their policies are plummeting. Israel's policies are going out the window. And when the main talk in Israel media is an immediate aggressive attack on Iran, the nuclear security summit of December is not a comfortable option for the Zionist regime, especially considering that the only reliable option open for Israel to attack Iran is a nuclear one. Astonishing Israeli attack on Iran, okay, is what they're planning. Israeli efforts to defer the conference were open in the talks with the representatives of the Finnish government and are likely to intensify. So it's so it's what's going to happen here is they're pushing Isaac Obama. There's nothing new in such an attack. Isaac Obama, I gave samples of institutional political violence in Israel. I think it goes on. But anyway, it's just saying that it's really getting tense there, folks. And it looks like
there could be some kind of agreement.
Yeah, because what's going to happen is if they actually approve it, okay, and they say, look, here's a treaty. We're not going any more than 20%. You know what I mean? Why do you still want to kill us?
Yeah, they signed the non-proliferation treaty. They're open to inspectors.
Right.
Everybody has said they're not doing anything.
Right. Now,
it's only Israel who is a non-signatory who has a huge nuclear arsenal, who's the problem?
As well as North Korea. You know, there was just a shot-off one.
Yeah.
Know, and so many others. So it's really getting... It really
Pakistan gets, and India are the
Pakistan
other two.
Pakistan and India. And we're selling arms to India. I mean, what's that all about? You know what I mean? And Pakistan's been selling arms to the terrorists. So it's like, man, who's doing the foreign policy crap here? Michigan government unleashes armed raids on small pig farmers.
Forces farmer to shoot all his own pigs. I don't know what's going on
that.
There. It's very sad. Let's read that article.
You want to read that?
Yeah, I was very upset about that.
Before we get, I wanted to read the global warming one.
We'll do that now.
Which is next, but of course Monsanto has another nightmare article.
Oh, well, of course. And this is from naturalnews.com. Natural News can now confirm that the Michigan Department of Natural Resources has, in total violation of the Fourth Amendment, conducted two armed raids on fig farms in that state, one in Kalaska County at Fife Lake and another in Sheboygan County. Staging raids involving six vehicles and 10 armed men, DNA conducted, that's the Department of Natural Resources, conducted unconstitutional, illegal, and arguably criminal armed raids on these two farms with the intent of shooting all the farmers' pigs under a bizarre new invasive species order that has suddenly declared traditional livestock to be an invasive species. Here it is down here. I think this is an unconstitutional order. These actions of the... These actions of the DNR are way out of bounds, Attorney Joseph O'Leary told Natural News in an interview today. He is representing one of the farmers who was targeted in these raids. To take what was 6 months ago an entirely legal activity and suddenly people are felons over it, they're not growing drugs, running guns, or killing anybody. They're raising animals pursuant to the USDA regulations and the state of Michigan regulations. They haven't done anything wrong. And the DNR is treating them like they're hardened criminals. In anticipation of the DNR arriving on the scene, one farmer engaged in what only can be described as a heart-wrenching task of shooting his own pigs, one by one, including baby piglets, before the DNR arrived. This was to avoid being arrested as a felon. His livelihood is now completely destroyed as the state of Michigan has put him out of business. Even after this farmer informed the DNR that he had destroyed his entire herd of pigs, the DNR continued to illegally acquire a search warrant by providing false information to a court judge, then conducting an armed raid on his ranch to verify that the entire herd of pigs had indeed already been shot to death. That this took place satisfied the DNR, which is now showing itself to be engaged in mob-style destruction of targeted farming businesses through its mass murder agenda of Michigan's small-scale farm pigs. It was very traumatic for him. These guys are farmers. I know he cared very much for the animals there, and the DNR treats these like they are some kind of plant that needs to be exterminated rather than animals that people care about, said O'Leary. Here is what one of the raided farmers had to say about his experience of being forced to destroy his pigs. I was served a search warrant yesterday at 7:45 a.m. I have killed all my hogs. The DNR gave me papers that say I do not have any hogs on my property. All they saw were dead hogs laying around from my mass slaughtering. It took 12 guys four times in there to kill all of them, sows with young, pregnant sows, dozens of piglets, and an old mature boars. It has been a sad few weeks. Does anyone know what it feels like to open fire on 20 baby piglets in one group, which weigh between 5 pounds and 15 pounds? They are so adorable and cute. They comment to everyone that they never saw a fence built so tough, and no way would a hog get out of this area. One of the raids targeted Ron McKendrick of Renegade Ranch in Sheboygan County. His ranch was raided on Saturday morning, and DNR agents reportedly conducted an interrogation of his customers and his 75-year-old senior citizen employee. An order to gain access to his property, DNR bureaucrats acquired a temporary restraining order, which was used to bully their way into the property, a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Another raid was conducted against the farm of David Tuxbury. He's the man who was forced to shoot all his own pigs before the DNR agents arrived in order to avoid being arrested as a felon. That's disgusting.
What I don't understand is why these guys gave up so quick. What was that about? I mean, there is law somewhere. You'd think that they would have...
Based on the actions of the DNR, it is my belief that the DNR is a rogue criminal gang of government thugs who are murdering livestock, destroying the lives of farmers, and violating the constitutional right of Michigan citizens and engaging in outrageous acts of destruction of property, of private property. I believe it is the duty of law-abiding Michigan citizens to call for the immediate arrest of DNR officials who must be brought to justice for their crimes against Michigan farmers. Every agent of the DNR that participated in these raids must be brought to justice to answer for their crimes. If the use of force is necessary to make lawful and legal arrests of these criminal Michigan government agents, then such use of force is fully authorized under the United States Constitution, as well as the Constitution of the State of Michigan. It is under these laws, in fact, that police officers are given firearms to use in the protection of the people. In Texas, the state constitution even says that farmers have the right to use lethal force to prevent someone from committing felony crime against their property. This includes shooting horse thieves, for example, and being in the right to do so.
Yeah. No government has any right to terrorize its citizens in the way witnessed here with the DNR of Michigan. These people are utterly out of control, waging a private war against selective targets using taxpayer debt money to destroy the lives of productive Michigan citizens. These DNS agents are dangerous and clearly psychologically imbalanced. They deliberately need to be reminded of the tenets of lawful government and the rights of citizens. They need to be immediately arrested and given the privilege of a trial by jury to answer for their crimes against farmers. I so agree with you. But anyway, there's a hearing on Friday somewhere.
Yeah.
Let's
see.
In Michigan.
Right here, a court hearing scheduled for Friday at 9 a.m. in the courthouse in Sheboygan County. I've been told that a very important legal strategy to halt this DNR madness will be unveiled in the courtroom that morning. Ron McKendrick, whose ranch was raided by DNR over the weekend, will be appearing in this hearing.
He's calling all patriots and everybody there to get hold of this guy. If you're interested, you can call the office of Governor Rick Snyder.
When you call, demand the investigation and arrest of the DNR workers who conspired to conduct these illegal and illegitimate raids on the Michigan farmers.
Right. Yeah, make sure you talk about the DNR.
It's the Department of Natural Resources.
You know, and their handling of the destruction of these farms and these pig farms.
You wonder if they were paid off by big business to do this.
Yeah, here's a phone number. 516-373-3400. And that's the phone to Governor Rick Snyder's office. So, it's about 20 after. We got our guests coming up in about 10 minutes. And what I would like to do is I wanted to read her a couple of one of her letters. Most recent articles. It's very quick.
Just a short one.
Yeah, but it's important to read it. Did you want to read it, or do you want me to start? Or we can both
All banks are not created equal. How people can use public banks to support Wall Street greed. This is by Ellen Brown. It is well known that Philadelphia was the birthplace of the U.S. Constitution and American democracy. Less well known is that it was also the birthplace of public banking in America. The Philadelphia Quakers originated a banking model involving government-issued money lent to farmers. The profits returned to the government and the people in a sustainable feedback loop that nourished and supported the local economy. Both landmark events will be commemorated in an up-and-coming gathering in Philadelphia, on April 7th, which has already passed, during Occupy Philly's celebration of its six-month anniversary on the mail in front
the
of
mall.
In the mall in front of I can't see in the mall in front of Independence Hall. The Occupy Philly Greedy General Assembly reached consensus in support of the National Gathering Working Group proposal to hold an Occupy National Gathering at the same location from June 30th to July 4th, 2012. The endorsement included a commitment by Occupy Philly to provide the resources necessary to make the first Occupy National Gathering in history a resounding success. The stage was thus set for what could be a revolutionary event located in the historic birthplace of the first American Revolution.
Resonating with that theme, on April 27th, the Public Banking in America conference will be held at the Quaker Friends Center in Philadelphia, hosted by the Public Banking Institute, which is Ellen Brown, and PBI's vision to establish a network of public banks across the country to generate affordable
credit
according to the priorities of people, real people, not corporate persons or banks. These priorities include student loans, sustainable agriculture, worker-owned coops.
Co-ops.
I'm sorry, co-ops. Thank you. Renewable energy, and so on. The Bank of North Dakota, currently the only publicly owned depository bank in the USA, has over two dozen loan programs reflecting the priorities of the people of North Dakota. And freeing the American people from the economic injustices perpetrated by Wall Street is what Occupy Wall Street is all about. We have become slaves to the economic power of Wall Street and their political lackeys. We now pay obscene amounts of interest to private bankers in exchange for the necessities of life. And the American public thought it was chasing the two pillars of the American dream, getting an education and buying a house. Now both of these pillars have been used against us to further the interests of Wall Street. Student and mortgage debt are used to club us into servitude. And Samuel Adams said of those whose allegiance was to money, if you love wealth greater than liberty, the tranquility of servitude greater than the animating cost for freedom, go home from us in peace. We seek not your counsel nor your arms, and crouch down and lick the hand that feeds you. May your chains set lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that ye were our countrymen.
After over 6 months of OWS protests over economic injustice, the Occupy National Gathering and Public Banking in America conference will look at solutions inspired by the revolutionary efforts of those who came before us in the birthplace of American freedom, Philadelphia. And Ellen Brown developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. In Web of Debt, her latest of 11 books, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we, the people, can get it back. She is president of the Public Banking Institute.
Yeah, you can go to publicbankinginstitute.org.
She has quite a resume.
Webofdebt.com. Right? And let's see. That was her latest article, which we're privileged to have tonight, is coming out tomorrow in the Huffington Post, I believe. But it says, the European Stabilization Mechanism, or How the Golden Vampire Squid Just Captured Europe. And the Goldman Sachs coup that failed in America has nearly succeeded in Europe. A permanent, irrevocable, unchallengeable bailout for the banks underwritten by the taxpayers. In September 2008, Hank Paulson, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, managed to extort a $700 billion bailout from Congress. But to pull it off, he had to fall on his knees and threaten the collapse of the entire global financial system and the imposition of martial law, and the bailout was a one-time affair. Paulson's plea for a permanent bailout fund, the Troubled Asset Release Fund, or TARP, was opposed by Congress and ultimately rejected.
Thank God.
By December of 2011, European Central Bank President Mario Draghi, a former vice president of Goldman Sachs Europe, was able to approve a $500 billion euro bailout for European banks without asking anyone's permission. And in January 2012, a bailout rescue funding program called the European Stability Mechanism was passed in the dead of night, with barely even a mention in the press. And the ESM imposes an open-ended debt on EU member governments, putting taxpayers on the hook for whatever the ESM's bureaucrat overseers demand. That's amazing, guys.
Yep.
That's amazing what's happening here. And the bankers' coup has triumphed in Europe seemingly without a fight. And the ESM is cheered by Eurozone governments, their creditors, and their market alike, because it means investors will keep buying sovereign debt. All is sacrificed to the demands of the creditors, because where else can the money be had to float the crippling debt of the Eurozone governments? And there is another alternative to debt slavery to the banks. But first, a closer look at the nefarious underbelly of the ESM and Goldman's silent takeover of the ECB. The ESM is a permanent rescue facility slated to replace the temporary European Financial Stability Facility and European Financial Stabilization Mechanism as soon as member states representing 90% of the capital commitments have ratified it, something that is expected to happen in July 2012.
Huh.
A December 10, 2011 YouTube video entitled The Shocking Truth of the Pending EU Collapse, originally posted in German, gives such a revealing look at the ESM that it is worth quoting here at length.
And it's a whole quote of this whole bill.
Right.
It's quite long. It'll be worth your while to go and look it up and read it.
Here's a great one. The ESM, its property, funding, and assets shall enjoy immunity from every form of judicial process. Question. So the ESM program can sue us, but can't challenge it.
But we can't challenge it in court.
That's amazing. The property, funding, and asset of ESM shall be immune from search, requisition, confiscation, expropriation, or any other form of seizure, taking on or foreclosed, jure, or by executive, judicial, or whatever ways. And question, this means that neither our governments nor our legislatures nor any of our democratic laws have any effect on the ESM organization. That's pretty powerful treaty. Okay. So
talk about signing your life away. That's what people did.
And Goldman Squid captures the ECB, said last November, without fanfare, barely notice. I just read that. This is the actual thing. But on the 21st of December, the ECB lent 489 billion euros to European banks at the extreme rate of just 1% over 3 years. I say lent, but in reality, they just ran the printing presses. And ECB doesn't have the money to lend. It's quantitative easing again. And the money was gobbled up virtually instantaneously by a total of 523 banks. It's complete madness, and the ECB hopes that the banks will do something useful with it, like lending the money to the Greeks, who are currently paying 18% to the bond market to get money. But there are absolutely no strings attached. If the banks decide to pay bonuses with the money, that's fine.
Oh, that's what they did here.
Or they might just shift all the money to tax havens.
And that, too.
That's what they did, too. So it's really bizarro. And this is going to come out in the next, tomorrow, I think. Tomorrow in Huffington Post. European Stabilization Mechanism, or how the Goldman Sachs, the Goldman Vampire Squid, just captured Europe, by Ellen Brown. And you can check that on Web of Debt, which is her. And and please don't forget publicbankinginstitute.org. Now we're going to call her.
Yep. Leo's going to give her a call. Second. takes a minute to call our guests, so bear with us.
Yeah.
We've had her on before, and she really is knowledgeable. She does a wonderful job. She's a very bright woman. And I think when she puts her mind to something, she really knows, she really goes after it. And she's been speaking around the country and probably in, I wouldn't be surprised if she's done some speaking in Europe, too.
She has. She was in Germany recently.
I mean, what she has to say makes a lot of sense. I mean, public banking is the way to go. I mean, you lend money to someone in business, they pay that debt back to the town or to whoever, that public bank, the state, and the people in the state. Fabulous way to do business.
Yeah.
Everybody benefits. Business. She's probably there.
Hello.
Hi, Ellen. How are you? It's Leo.
Yeah, hi, fine.
Good evening, okay. Ellen. It's Lila also. I'm with Leo. It's a pleasure to have you on again.
Oh, great. Hi, Lila.
And I notice you're still writing and you're still talking. And it sounds like you're moving forward. But for the folks who are listening who don't know, you're president of the Public Banking Institute. And could you tell them a little bit about that?
The Public Banking Institute is, we're a volunteer organization, but we're promoting the idea that we could solve the banking crisis by a public option in banking, by having states, counties, cities set up their own banks, put their revenues in their banks, and use that, leverage their own revenues for credit for the local economy, instead of giving that credit power away to Wall Street, which tends to use it to bet against us or to invest against us or to lend it back to us at much higher rates than what they're paying us. I saw that California, for example, has $70 billion in an investment pool. The treasurer has that much money in an investment pool. That's what he does with the revenues. He keeps like $2 billion in transaction accounts to pay the regular budget, and then the excess goes into this investment pool. So that money's just been sitting there for a decade. It's now earning 0.49% interest, so it's earning almost nothing. And meanwhile, California has to borrow at something like 5% interest from these same banks that we're putting our money into, and they're not actually lending their money or their depositors' money. They create credit on their books whenever they make a loan. That's the secret of banking that most people don't realize, and that's what, you know, I keep writing and writing and writing about, that the power, the credit power, the power to create money as credit should belong to the people, that it's in the Constitution that Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. If you're going to regulate the value of money, that means you get to basically issue it. And instead, that power has been given over to banks. So it's pretty hopeless at the federal level to get it back, but we still have some leverage at the state and local level that you can still get to your politicians. There, we now have 17 bills, or 17 states that have introduced bills of one sort or another for either to form a state-owned bank or to study the possibilities, to do a feasibility study.
Anyone, so
we're having a conference next week on that.
Anyone close to achieving that? I know you said there was a big movement in California last time you were on.
Yeah, we got the closest of anyone. The bill passed both houses of Congress, or of the legislature, but the governor didn't sign it because he said it was a bill for a study, and he said that we didn't need any more studies, that we already had a banking commission and that they could study it in-house. So now the same man who brought that bill, Ben Hueso of San Diego, it has brought another bill. He brought it about a month ago for this bill is for an actual bank, not for a study. So hopefully,
yeah,
if it has the same success, that would be great.
Oh, that'd be
and then Hawaii's gotten quite close. They've their bill has gone through one committee after another, pretty much hands down, so, or hands up or whatever. In other words, everybody's in favor of it, so that bill could well pass.
Well, great.
And that the Hawaii model is particularly interesting because they put in a provision about foreclosures so that the state bank could take over these abandoned and foreclosed properties and do something with them, you know, rent them back or sell them back or do some sort of fair workout for the homeowners.
Would the banks that have, that hold the foreclosures now would they be able to do anything there? You're saying that they wanted, would they be buying them out?
Actually, it's been a while since I looked at that particular model, but here's what we're proposing in what they're proposing in Arizona. There's another bill, which is not actually a state bank bill, but it's a bill to take over these properties by eminent domain. And what we're proposing, there'll be one man speaking on this at our conference next week, to have county banks, you know, it's the counties that are particularly in trouble because of all this foreclosure mess. Their county recorders are up in arms because their title records are all messed up because of MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, that properties have been bought and sold in little pieces and nobody really knows who owns them anymore. Courts are holding that all these properties that are held in the name of this shell corporation, that the shell, MERS, doesn't have standing to foreclose and doesn't actually have title, and so that breaks the chain of title. So what we're saying that a county could do is to just put a notice in the paper and say, we are going to take these various properties by eminent domain. This would particularly be the blighted, foreclosed, abandoned. And then they would get them for free because nobody could prove title.
Could the court hold that up still by saying that there's no clear title, therefore you can't do that?
Or you can do
it. Well, it's because what the counties can do, this is typical of eminent domain, is you put a notice in the paper and you say, anybody who can prove title will pay fair market value for this property. And even if they have to pay fair market value, that's, you know, so cheap. And here we have all these investors groups coming along and buying up all these cheap properties, and then they're going to rent them back, and then of course they're going to hold them until the prices rise, and here we're going to be stuck with buying the same real estate all over again at the top that we, well, I shouldn't say we, I don't have any, but you know what I mean, that got lost.
So
we should, the government should step in and stop those big investors that are just parasitizing
That's a wonderful idea, and they're going forward with that in Arizona?
The bill is going forward so far. It hasn't passed, but it passed the first round, I guess.
People are really listening and trying to do something. That's wonderful. I wanted you to tell me a little bit. Did you go to the rally in April in Philadelphia on the 7th? Were you there?
No, I wasn't there, but I did write about it, that they decided to hold a sort of like a constitutional convention. I mean, they don't want to sound too revolutionary for political reasons, but, you know, I mean, in other words, they're going to hold a big national convention in July where occupiers can get together and try and work out a plan of some sort, or at least get organized, get together. Everybody complains that they're not very organized, but in a way that's their strength because it's kept them from being shot down.
So this is open to occupiers from across the country will be present at this, like the Occupy Boston, the Occupy New York. So it's a big
event. That's the plan, national gathering.
Because we still have some here in Connecticut. We still have some occupiers in New Haven. They've been able to maintain their spot there.
They're still in tents? Wow, that's great.
Yeah, they're still in tents. They have a stay in the federal court in New York, and I think they're going down this week to argue their case to stay. The land is not public land, as everyone thought. The land is private land in the Occupy New Haven case. So I don't know exactly what that means, but we'll see. But so far, they're there, and even though on, I think it was last week, they were going to remove them, they got a stay about an hour after they began the removal, after the police began the removal process. So we'll see what happens. So they're one of the few that are still around.
Yeah, I'm amazed they made it through the winter in Connecticut.
I know. Well, we had a mild winter this winter, thank God. Maybe that contributed to it. But I got to give those guys a lot of credit.
I know.
And girls. I'm sure there are women there, too, who were able to do that.
They had a lot of problems there, too. They stuck it out. But,
yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. But,
But the movement is still there, even without camping out. I mean, it's still there on the Internet, largely. It's because of the Internet, I think, that there is a movement.
Well, I'm glad to see that that your organization is so involved with that movement as well, as it should be. And are you getting any more recruits from the Occupy Wall Street group towards public banking, or at least a better understanding of it?
Well, there's definitely communication there, yeah. It's one of the proposed solutions.
Right.
Well,
it's
certainly
public banking.
Public banking, I think, is probably at the root of it. I mean, because you can't do anything without money. You can't really create change without money. Everything is costly. And this is a way for everyone to benefit. It really is a win-win for the people. Maybe not for Goldman Sachs and the big banks who have been stealing from the American public, but this would be a great thing for ordinary American citizens, and I so hope that this will happen across the country. Now, have you been speaking around the country, and have you been to Europe to speak? We read your article on European banking and the EU. That's kind of a mess right now over there.
Yeah, well, I have done a lot of speaking lately. I'm trying to get another book done, but I can't seem to get out there. I was just in Canada for a week because I was invited by the former defense minister, Paul Hellyer, who started a political party that had money reform as its major platform, the Canadian Action Party. And so I went up there and spoke and wrote an article on their budget crisis, which to me is an artificial crisis. That's what I was writing about. I mean, I just get these ideas from the money reformers that have been around for decades and that talk about them and write about them, but I seem to be able to get them out into the whole Internet circuit. So I wrote about the Canadians in 1935 nationalized they set up a central bank, the Bank of Canada, and in 1939 it was nationalized, and they started using it to fund all sorts of projects. So they just issued credit, which is what a central bank should do, and you know it's what Ben Bernanke's done, or what our Fed has done, issuing quantitative easing, but they've only done it for the benefit of the banks. And also in Europe, they have the ECB, but it's issuing cheap credit only for the benefit of the banks, not for the benefit of the governments. Well, in Canada, for 35 years, they did use their central bank to fund their participation in World War II, or much of it. They developed seaways and roadways and just all kinds of development across the country, and they set up their excellent healthcare system. It's not as excellent as it once was because of all this budget cutting, but for a time there, it was everybody had basically healthcare coverage from the government, and that was all done with this national credit issued by the central bank. And during that time, the debt did not rise. These were called basically self-liquidating loans that, because they were interest-free, that cuts the cost of these projects almost in half, and so it's easier to pay the loans back. And because they invested in things that were that tended to stimulate the economy, so they'd get the money back in taxes. That it was easy to pay these debts off. So the debt level stayed low and stable all the way up until 1974. And at that point, they quit borrowing from their central bank because Canada joined the Basel Committee. Then they joined the Bank for International Settlements and became, it was the Group of Six, and then it became the Group of Seven when Canada joined, and then it was a Group of Ten, and now it's a Group of 20 that set the standards globally for banking. And their alleged goal is to maintain the stability of the currency. And in order to do that, supposedly, you can't borrow from your own central bank and you can't issue money because that would be inflationary. That's the argument. But of course, what they're overlooking or not telling you is that almost all our money comes from private banks. It doesn't come from central banks, and that private banks issue money, create money on their books as credit in the very same way that a central bank would do. The difference is if the government has to borrow from private banks, they have a big interest bill. In fact, mm-hmm. Canada has now paid twice as much in interest as their current debt is, and we've probably paid as much in interest as our debt is. So if we'd been borrowing interest-free from our own central bank all along, we would have no debt. I added up the interest we paid in the last 24 years. That's how far back the FDIC website reports it, or the Fed's website, one of them, I forget. Anyway, in the last 24 years, we paid $8.2 trillion in interest.
That's
and the debt is $15 trillion. So that's almost two-thirds of the debt we paid in interest.
So Canada managed to take a step backwards and be just like us.
Yeah, so now they've got this big debt trap like everyone else, and now they're slashing services and selling off assets and doing the same thing. That now they're in the austerity mode, which clearly doesn't work. And the thing is they've got a clear model. They can look back in their own history and see how well it works. I mean, here it's just kind of hypothetical. We say, well, you should just borrow from your own central bank. That would fix it. But they can point to their own data and how well it actually worked in Canada. So I think they might be the first to break through.
Well, that would be great. I sure hope they do. Tell us a little bit, if you can, about what's happening with the European Union financially.
The European Union was in the same sort of fix where, the sovereign debt crisis, where Greece is paying 18%, for example, on their debt. Well, at 18%, debt doubles in 4 years. So it's a huge. The crisis is the interest. If they had been again, if they had been borrowing from their own central bank, they wouldn't. They had quite a low debt not very long ago, quite reasonable, manageable debt up until the rating agencies started saying that they had a debt problem, and then downgraded them, and then the investors drove up the interest rate, or the speculators drove up the interest rate. So then they did have a debt problem. In fact, I was talking to somebody from Italy. She's a professor, and she said Italy had no debt problem until the same thing happened. The rating agencies came in and started saying they had a debt problem, and then their interest rate shot up, and now they do have a debt problem because that you can double your bill by driving up the interest rate.
Oh, boy.
So all those countries have no way of paying that off except borrowing from banks, which issue money privately in the same way that a central bank would do, except they issue it at interest. So the ECB, the European Central Bank, just recently under Mario Draghi, who was a former Goldman Sachs, I think he was vice president of Goldman Sachs International. He is now head of the European Central Bank. So he, in January, made these very low interest loans to the banks. Same thing that Ben Bernanke did to bail out the banks, you know, just gave them credit. But the obvious or the more direct solution would be to give that cheap credit to the government. Instead, the banks get it at 1%. And then they turn around and lend it to the governments at 18% and get that very nice spread for themselves. It's all about bailing out the creditors and not about bailing out the governments, which is what it should be about.
Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get out from under that. It seems to me they're in a little worse shape than we are because those decisions are made by the European Union, aren't they?
Yes, and they don't have a political unity like we do. In other words, we don't mind helping out Louisiana or some state that's in trouble because we all feel like that's us.
Mm-hmm.
But they're independent political entities trying to share a financial system, which just won't work unless they also share a political system.
And that's what's really burying them all, I think, and creating.
Well, but I think that whole structure is being encouraged by financial interests that are profiting from the whole thing.
Oh, sure they are. They're profiting handsomely from that.
Yeah.
And, of course, if all the people are suffering, just like people are suffering in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But where I always thought the EU was going to fail anyway was just trying to get 10 sovereign nations that have virtually warred against each other for 500 years or more to agree on everything, you know?
Well,
or even on anything, especially on the sovereignty of their money.
Well, all you have to do is make someone an economic slave, and they have nothing left. They've lost their liberty. They conquered them all. It was a bloodless revolution, that whole thing.
Yeah. The idea of the EU in the first place was to prevent these competitive devaluations where they were competing against each other with their currencies. So the thought was, well, if we have one currency, we can solve that. But obviously, like you say, that doesn't solve anything because they still are competing. They're competing in different ways.
Yeah.
And they've kept their own money. You know, England kept its own money.
Well, they were smart.
The pound.
Yeah, they were. Although they're not doing that well either, because they're also in this whole austerity syndrome.
Yeah, they've had to bail out too, haven't they? They're part of that European bailout.
Right. But now I know that you went to
Germany.
To Germany, and you spoke there or attended a lecture of some sort.
Now they have a separate bank.
They have a central bank.
No, Germany's part of the.
Why do they have such a? Why are they so prosperous as opposed to the other?
Oh, well, what I had written about was that their local banks are public banks, so they have a very strong public banking system, and they're publicly owned by the local communities.
Oh.
So those banks support their industries, their local industries. And
so
that has given them a competitive edge globally, and that's what they were the world's biggest exporters right up until China passed them up. And I mean, that's pretty good for such a small country.
Absolutely.
And for a country that was totally devastated in World War II, I mean, they managed to pull themselves up, but they had a supportive local banking system.
So that the larger cities have their own banks? Is that how that works?
Yeah, or the provincial, I'm not sure what the, I think it's cities and provinces. The Landesbanks are the larger, you know, the equivalent of states, but they don't have states. I think that they're called provinces.
Uh-huh.
And then they're the local city banks as well. Under
so
them,
bank
a lot of little.
What saved them so far and has been saving them all along, as opposed to Spain or Greece or what, you know,
Portugal or Ireland.
I mean, what is the nightmare scenarios here for these countries, or are they all going to be bailed out?
Well, I just wrote it. They're just about to sign this European Stability Mechanism, the treaty, under which it'll be a permanent bailout fund. Supposedly for the sovereign governments, but really it's a bailout fund for the creditors, which means for the banks.
Yeah.
So the banks will always be able to extort their money, and they'll be extorting it from the governments, which means from the taxpayers who support the governments. So I've got an article that's coming out in Truth Out tomorrow about that. I mean, hopefully that can be stopped. Hopefully they're not so...
Now, who signed that, Ellen? Like Germany, France?
I think it needs to be ratified, but it was signed in January, and it was everybody cheered it, like, oh, great, now we have a bailout fund, a permanent bailout fund, but it's really not a good thing at all. It's mischaracterized, so that's why I was writing about it.
Yeah, I was just wondering who signed it, whether it was signed by the bureaucrats in Belgium and then gets ratified by the various countries, or how that worked.
I'm not sure. It's a good question. I should look into it.
I was just curious about that, because so much of that European Union, your sovereignty is passed on to these bureaucrats, you know, who are probably representatives of bankers. Who knows what they are?
Yeah. We've got the same problem, like with treaties we sign. Nobody votes on those treaties, and we certainly, I mean, even Congress doesn't vote on those treaties.
No.
Well, the treaties
that's going to unite Mexico and Canada and the United States, I mean, we have highways going through the country. We have all kinds of things
with
that free trade thing, that North American
Union.
Most Congress people don't even seem to know anything about it.
Well, they do. They won't talk about it.
I don't know exactly what it is.
Hardly does much good to vote, because your vote really doesn't seem to have any input. I mean, no matter which side you vote for, Congress just goes its own way and does its own thing. Congress doesn't really even understand the issues. I mean, how could you understand a 3,000-page bill?
Yeah.
They should have a law against long bills, I think.
You know, you're the second most well-known activist that I've heard say don't vote this coming election.
Well, I'm not saying not to vote, but it's, you know, there aren't any good choices. It's so frustrating.
Well, you know, Ralph Nader was the other one that came out with that this year. He was just totally fed up with what they've been doing, and he just came out and said, you know, the only way you can teach these people, to tell these people that you don't want either of them, is by not voting, you know, and you know, take it from there and not voting.
Well, it would be nice if we had a third-party candidate.
If I were
writing a novel or a movie, I would have a third-party candidate who's so popular that it's a write-in and everybody writes his name in and wins. But it only works in the movies, you know. It doesn't really work with Paul.
But what's your feeling about Ron Paul's concepts? What do you think his
I agree in part and disagree in part, but he's better than the alternatives, the Republican alternatives, but there's something corrupt about the whole process, because he seems to have so much support, and yet he always seems to lose.
Election process is so manipulated and so rigged.
Well, do you think that his message of end the Fed is the right way, is
a good message?
Well, it was certainly a good message to investigate the Fed, or to force them to come up
audit
with, audit the Fed, right, show their numbers. I don't know if you saw recently, Ben Bernanke has come out. I mean, he's the only one that seems to be standing up for the homeowners. He's saying that they should have, that the banks should write down the mortgages, because that's the only way you're going to deal with all these underwater mortgages. I mean,
what are they going to do with all that? What are they going to do with them? You know, people can't pay them off, so they take them, and then they still have nothing. You know, they have a $200,000 house with a $500,000 mortgage on it, you know? So,
well, that's that Arizona bill would buy up the mortgages, not even the ones that are in foreclosure, but anybody who wants to have their mortgage bought up, they could, government entity
would
take it by eminent domain, and then they could buy it back at fair market value.
Absolutely. I would.
Be great if that could happen.
Yeah.
certainly people have come up with some wonderful ideas that sound like they're very, very viable, and all we need is the momentum to pass it. And it's great what you're doing, Ellen. You've created a lot of interest, and you've written a lot of wonderful articles that have really opened people's eyes. And I know it's helped me understand the banking system, which was a complete mystery to me until I got some information from you, from your articles. And I really thank you for that.
Oh, great. Well, I'll just give my website if I may.
Right.
So all my articles are on my website, webofdebt.com. Under the articles tab, I think there's 130 articles there. And then we have our public banking website is publicbankinginstitute.org.
All right, so people can get to that, read more about you and more about maybe where you're speaking and what's happening. And that's great. Thank you very much, Ellen.
Yeah, thank you, Ellen, for being with us.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks, you too.
Good night. And that was Ellen Brown. And she...
we should have asked her about her new book that she was writing. I knew I had one more question for her that I wanted to ask. She said she was writing
here.
Oh, Ellen, I wanted to ask you quickly about your new book.
I'm writing on public banking, the whole concept of... You know, I did write partly on that in Web of Debt. But I'm expanding on that whole part, tracing the whole history of public banking, going all the way back to the Sumerians and the competition between public and private banking. The more you research this stuff, I mean, there's just all this stuff that we just haven't been told, all this information that once you know, it changes your whole perception of history.
Oh, my.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading that. That sounds like it'll be very interesting.
Oh, thanks. The title is The Buck Starts Here, Restoring Prosperity with Publicly Owned Banks.
Oh,
well, we'll look forward to that.
When do you think that'll be out?
I was hoping it would be out now, but it's not. So maybe 2 months, I'd say in 2 months.
Oh, we definitely want to have you when that...
definitely. I'd like to hear more about that. Right.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Bye.
Good night.
Good night, now. Hold on, folks. There we go.
All right.
Anyway, it takes me a few minutes here to
get this thing to work. We have a few little glitches and stuff here.
Yeah.
So what else do we have
here?
So
we want to thank her again.
Yeah, that was great. I'm looking forward to that for her new book. That would be very interesting.
Yeah. And we got Pete coming up in a little while. He's not here yet. But does he know to call him?
Yeah, I left him a message. Hopefully he'll be able to call. I didn't hear from him.
Okay. That's right. So anyway, let's just go to a quick little...
music break. We're going to give him a call. I think he's having trouble getting us. And so Leo's calling him. He's putting the number in right now. So he's going to give him a call. Sometimes people have trouble getting in. I don't know why.
Okay, let's try this one. If it doesn't work, then we have to...
Hello?
Hey, how are you? You couldn't dial in?
No, I had dialed in. I actually sat there and listened to you trying to dial me, and you had some kind of technical problems. I've been on hold for the last 5 minutes listening to you guys go back and forth.
Well, you're not. You haven't shown up on the
it's
screen.
It's funny. Your number didn't show up on our screen saying that you were there.
Right.
Yeah, no. I've been in the queue. I've been in the queue sitting there listening.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know. We'll have to call them and tell them that we had a problem. But we'll. Are you ready to begin your segment?
Oh, sure. I'm always ready.
Okay. Go right ahead. We're a step in the ring with Woody.
Thank you, Lila. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, plenty of NFL and baseball news. So let's get right down to it. The New York Jets began their off-season training program on Monday by answering questions about their potential quarterback controversy. Of course, yes, the Jets, there is no controversy. One day after the newly acquired Tim Tebow was booed at Yankee Stadium, now, the reason he was booed at Yankee Stadium is because most Yankee fans are Giant fans, so they're not going to be kind of swept up in the Tim Tebow thing. It has nothing to do with booing Tim Tebow, the man. It's more of booing him as a Jet. Anyway, according to Jets coach Rex Ryan, he said the former Denver Bronco quarterback can serve as a potent complement to incumbent Mark Sanchez. Of course, Mark is our starter, no question about it, Ryan said. But we know Tim can help us, too. He's an outstanding football player. Ryan added, anytime you're out on the field, it's competitive, and you do need to perform, but Mark is our quarterback. Sanchez will help New York reach the AFC Championship game in each of his first two seasons before an uneven 2-11. We'll start on the same footing as Tebow in one respect. New offensive coordinator Tony Sperano, whose team initially used the Wildcat attack to great advantage when he was with Miami Dolphins head coach, distributed playbooks for the first time Monday. The Jets think Tebow, acquired on March 21st after the Broncos signed free agent Peyton Manning, can be extremely effective in that formation. Now, as I recall, the Jets only used that formation 43 times and resulting in 2 touchdowns. And if you look at that in the span of a whole season, I mean, that's a very small slice of your offensive season, 43 plays. It's a very small slice. And, you know, my personal opinion on Tebow is he's going to sit there and say, yeah, I'll be the backup. Yeah, I'll be the backup. Yeah, I'll be the backup. And just yes everybody to death. And of course, all along, he has lines on, you know, he wants to be a starter. You know, Tim Tebow is one thing. He's a quarterback. He's not a halfback. He's not a running back. He's not a wide receiver. No, he's a quarterback. He's just a running quarterback. And I think this is definitely going to – changes are going to happen. As I said weeks ago, I think the Jets were, you know, possibly searching for a new quarterback. And I think Tebow is going to end up being the starter at some point. Either Sanchez is not going to be going right, which is a distinct possibility, or Sanchez will get injured, and they'll make it real easy. But I know one thing is for sure. Tim Tebow did not come to town to sit on the bench. I just don't see it, and I think the Jets are deluding themselves, and Denver knows better, too. You know, Denver knows better, and that's why they got rid of him. You know, he didn't come to sit on the bench. He's not a prolific quarterback. He's a prolific winning quarterback because the guy does definitely win. I just don't think it's going to work out for him and the Jets, but, you know, we'll certainly see. Speaking of new faces, new places, new Denver quarterback Peyton Manning was excited to finally be at work with his teammates at team's practice facility on Monday. Manning, who was released by the Colts, as you all may recall, last month after 14 seasons, apparently, most of the Broncos participated in the nearly four hours of morning workouts that signaled the beginning of the club's off-season conditioning program. Coaches are not allowed to participate until organized team activities begin in May, but that certainly didn't stop Manning. You know, he worked the offense separately from the defense, and players spent time watching films, lifting weights, you know, just basic football activities. The four-time NFL MVP said he was pleased with his official first day of work with the team. So we'll see more in the future how Manning's neck holds up. I think that's going to be the big question. Other interesting stuff going on in the NFL. Attention all drunks. If you're ejected from a stadium this season, you might have to complete a four-hour online class on proper conduct to get back inside for future games. And, of course, you'll have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Eight teams who are down with this little ruling, Buffalo Bills, Cleveland Browns, Indianapolis Colts, Atlanta Falcons, New York Giants, New York Jets, Green Bay Packers, and the New England Patriots. So if you're an ejected fan, you got to complete this class, and it kind of educates them on the NFL's fan code of conduct policy. Fans and responsible drinking. Says Ari Novak, a psychotherapist specializing in anger management who created the program. This is probably a good move. The NFL likes to portray itself as a family-oriented league, and, you know, you want to be able to bring your kids to the stadium, and some people just get outrageously drunk, and, you know, people who wear opposing teams' colors are attacked or at least verbally abused. And personally, I think that might be all right in the adult world, but when there's kids around, it's not really the kind of stuff you want kids to see, you know, drunk people just acting drunk, you know, how drunks act. So I think that's probably a good thing for the NFL, and, you know, maybe some guys will get something out of it. Frankly, I kind of doubt it. Most people that go to those games and get totally tanked, you're not going to a four-hour online class probably isn't going to make much of a difference, but we'll certainly see. As I said, you know, Monday the teams were doing a little bit of workout, and for the New Orleans Saints, you know, they had a suspended coach, an unsigned quarterback. They're doing union business, and a team owner is very busy adding with a local basketball team to his holdings. But he's not answering NFL-related questions. Coach Sean Payton was in day one of his full-season league-imposed suspension in connection with the Saints' bounty program. Interim coach Joe Vitt will oversee the off-season program if it faces a 6-game suspension of its own at the start of the regular season as a result of the bounties. Amid the turmoil, just assigned the special teams ace, Courtney Robey, was upbeat. He felt good to be around all of my teammates and looking forward to a special season. Look out, world, Robey tweeted. But frankly, the man who makes the Saints go, quarterback Drew Brees, was in New York as a member of the executive committee of the NFL Players Association. He and others from the union met with league officials on topics that include HGH testing, which is going to be, guys do not want that to happen, believe me when I tell you. Bounty issues, obviously. And George Italia of the NFL Players Association spokesman said the NFL had yet to provide the union with evidence to prove the bounty allegations. Yeah, just deny it, and they never happened. We're hoping to ensure a fair and due process, Italia said. Yeah, just deny them, and they never happened. I mean, that always works. As I said, probably when this started a couple weeks ago, the bounty thing has been going on for an extremely long time. I remember back in the late 80s when guys from the Green Bay Packers defense were writing numbers of opposing Chicago Bears on towels, putting the towels around their waist, and, you know, that was their little hit towel. So this has been going on for a long time. And, you know, hey, the NFL's trying to clean it up. It's, you know, they want to make the league safer, and I can understand that. So good for the NFL. Let's move on to a little bit of baseball. All kinds of interesting stuff going on in baseball. As I said, during the winter, I thought that the Bobby Valentine hire in Boston was going to be explosive, to say the least. And, of course, Bobby has proven me to be correct. He has already gotten into it with veteran third baseman Kevin Youkilis. He questioned his commitment and his mental acuity during a TV interview on Sunday. According to player Dustin Detroit, he didn't really know what Bobby is trying to do. That's not the way we go about our stuff around here. He'll figure that out. The whole team is behind Uke. We have each other's backs here. So that kind of sounds like they have a little manager versus team thing going already. This totally does not surprise me. The Red Sox are a team where the core really hasn't changed for a while. And when teams kind of get like that, they get kind of clicky and stuff, and they don't want to hear stuff from, say, an outsider, such as a new manager or whatever, and things just don't go over all that well. And I think there's going to be more fireworks in Boston, you know, with Valentine and with, you know, guys that are star players. So this is just the beginning. The day after, you could see Kevin Youkilis and the general manager of the Boston Red Sox, Ben Sherrington. They were over by the batting cage, and gee, what do you think they were talking about? The GM of the Boston Red Sox, Ben Sherrington, as I said, is already not a big fan of Bobby Valentine. So Bobby Valentine is already making enemies all across the board up in Boston. I don't know how long this little experiment is going to last. The Red Sox, I can tell you this, do not look good up to this point. Their pitching has been real, real shape, just garbage. Lester got knocked out, I believe, in the second inning tonight. That's his second shortest start ever. The Yankees banged him out one time in the first inning, but Beckett has not been good either. You know, and they didn't make any improvements in their lineup. And, you know, I said this over the winter, that the Red Sox, I didn't think, you know, were going to be much of a threat, because to me, they made very little improvements on anything, you know. And they kind of kept the same team. I thought in order for them to make, you know, some positive changes, they needed to get rid of some people. And they haven't done that. And Youkilis, as I recall, has got a real rotten attitude, and he's just really less than charming. And that's kind of known. He's supposed to be one of the biggest assholes in Major League Baseball. And that's not a secret. That's a known fact. That's one of the reasons Joshua Chamberlain threw one about a foot over his head a couple of years ago, because Euclid has a huge mouth. So I expect the thing between him and Valentine, that's going to fester and going to get even better. So that bears watching. So I think watching the Boston Clubhouse is going to be a fun thing to do over the summer. And speaking of guys from the Boston Clubhouse and also from the New York Yankee Clubhouse, the Roger Clemens, always fun to talk about guy. The trial is getting ready to start. This is the second trial, second time around. Now, prosecutors said they might call former baseball players Barry Bonds, Jose Canseco, current baseball commissioner Bud Selig, and Yankees general manager Brian Cashman as witnesses in the Roger Clemens perjury case. That's kind of an ugly lineup for the prosecutors. The defense said they may call former Clemens teammates Paul O'Neill, Jorge Posada, Mike Stanton, and baseball writer Peter Gammons. Those were among the more than 100 potential witnesses read yesterday on the first day of jury selection in the Clemens new trial. This time, the prosecution team is certainly a lot larger. The last prosecution team was a little bit smaller. They only presented a couple of witnesses, and, you know, the case didn't go the way of the government. And the government spent a lot of money. They spent millions of dollars, and the case didn't go anywhere. But let me tell you something. This is the second time around. They have a bigger prosecution team, and they're on it, believe me. The government doesn't spend millions of dollars to prosecute you and then have the case go nowhere. Now, granted, Clemens isn't going to do 1,000 years in jail or anything like that. I'm not saying that. But the government's going to want to get a conviction, believe me, and that's why they're trying him this second time. They want a conviction. You know, there's going to be that mark on his history. So that's going to be very interesting to watch, because it's going to get real, real ugly in the courtroom. You can absolutely guarantee that. A little bit of Yankee news. Derek Jeter seems to be on a tear. He started out really fast this year. Not sure why. I'm just extremely pleased that Jeter's having a quick start. I think that whole 3,000 hit thing last year really was getting to him. And, you know, as you can see, after he hit the plateau, he was like old Derek Jeter again, swinging the bat great. And this year he's picked up right where he left off last year, so that's great. Good to see Derek Jeter swinging the bat. Classy guy. All right. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my wit heads out there. Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, Fallen Angel all the way down in Louisiana. That's it for this week. Enjoy the warm weather. Summer is on its way.
Thank you, Will.
Before the 2007 global
financial epidemic.
Before the 2007 global financial meltdown, suicides in European Union countries had fallen sharply among people under age 65. Now, thanks to misguided economic programs and the sheer greed of financiers, that trend has abruptly reversed. The new wave of suicides tracks closely with rising unemployment, and Ireland churches offer seminars on themes like suicide in recessionary times. Even more draconian austerity measures that strip income and social aid act as a toxin, leaving the population so stricken that for some, dying seems the only relief.
In Greece, taking one's own life is so deeply stigmatized by the Greek Orthodox Church that bodies are rejected for burial. Not surprisingly, suicide rates in the country have been historically low. Yet in 2011, when the jobless rate rose to 13.9% to 20.9%, calls to a major suicide hotline more than doubled, with 5,500 people talking of ending their lives. Hotline workers report a variety of underlying issues cited by callers, but job losses and deep cuts in salary are prominent. Callers who often reveal no previous history of mental illness testify to life changes too devastating to cope with. And a Greek Ministry of Health study found that the suicide rate in the first half of 2011 was 40% higher than the year before.
Greece now has the most rapidly increasing rate of suicide in Europe. Shocking headlines tell gruesome tales of the bankrupt and jobless, like Apostolos, 55, a Greek businessman who set his body ablaze outside the bank that refused to see him last September. He was eventually saved by police and shared his desperation. I don't feel proud about it, no way, but all these situations made me lose my self-respect and feel like I've been deprived of my rights, because being able to pay your taxes is not only an obligation but also a right. People should have the possibility to pay their taxes, to pay their obligations to others, to offer the basic goods to their families so they can feel that they live with self-respect and dignity. Most recently, the world shuddered at news of retired Greek pharmacist Dimitrios Christoulis, who shot himself in central Athens near the Greek Parliament, leaving behind a note that stated that the austerity measures that yanked his pension left him facing a life of rummaging through garbage pails and burdening his children. Jeez.
Squeezed dry by an economic crisis they did not cause, the people of Europe are left without any means to help themselves, and to many, death seems the only alternative. The religion of austerity. Across Europe, the economic philosophy of austerity has created a familiar cycle. Government spending cuts come on the heels of skyrocketing interest rates on the debt of member countries. This means that money secured from slashes to pensions, education, and medical services is funneled into higher interest payments. Meanwhile, the disappearing health care and mental health services leave little room for the people to rebound from economic shock, and government officials are viewed as the cynical instruments of debt collectors in bailout countries like Germany. The death spiral takes over.
If you pay attention to language, you begin to notice that those who preach austerity, mainly international bankers, along with politicians they have bought and the media who serve them, often use a specifically religious language to justify the pain they are causing. Words like cleansing, virtue, and sacrifice are common.
Yeah. And then there's just a little bit more here to this on another page, and I'm going to it.
In the postmodern world, elites deployed the language of austerity to influence religious populations with great success. Suffering was said to purify the soul, and those who renounced earthly abundance were promised rich rewards in the kingdom of heaven. In the Christian tradition, the image of gaunt and a suffering Christ forms the most iconic evocation of austerity. Images of desert fathers like Anthony the Great, who cleansed their minds and flesh by rejecting material became models of righteousness. Philosopher Michel Foucault has studied the politics and cultural significance of the idea of austerity, noting its cultural evolution from an emphasis on self-regulation to that of eliminating the pleasure in daily life. For many traditional proponents of austerity, suffering is all the better if endured alone with the penitent removed from the supports of the community and family. The cultivation of lack of feeling reduces the counterforces of empathy and desire that would naturally prevent human beings from agreeing to inflict pain upon themselves.
In today's global political climate, we've passed our time. But I've got two paragraphs left. So, in today's global political climate, the religious rhetoric of austerity is transferred to the economic realm. In a parody of older theories of how Protestantism paved the way for capitalism, the mind and bodies are not purified for God, but for the market. The citizens stripped of the excesses of a living wage and means for providing for basic needs is cut off from social support and instructed to endure a ritual of suffering. Then, properly cleansed, the sufferer arrives penitent before the priests of Mammon. All right? These priests offer to compensate the suffering not by a promise of entry into heaven, but through the illusion of economic relief. Meanwhile, they rob populations of the precious assets any chance of future prosperity depends upon.
The suicides of the Eurozone offer the ultimate challenge to the austerity priesthood. Those who die by their own hand are exiling themselves permanently from the kingdom of capitalism. They forego the possibility of the promised economic salvation and break the system's mandate of earthly suffering and submission. In their extreme act of exile, they refuse to serve an illusion. How many must die before the priests are held accountable for their false religion? So, on that note,
I feel pretty sad for those people out there, boy. And I'm sure it's all happening here too.
Yeah.
And we got the returning vets that are shooting themselves. 25% of them are going crazy. You know, so.
With reduced benefits and not good care.
Yeah.
They were young. They went to war. They thought they were doing a great thing. You know, they had no jobs. It's, you know.
All the promise of the future until they got their asses blown up.
It's the Hunger Games of 2012.
Yeah.
Well,
2012.
That's right.
So it is.
Yeah.
So folks.
It's the poor that go.
The poor go. Anyway, folks.
On that note, I guess we say goodnight, and we want to thank Ellen Brown for a wonderful interview and for once again educating us all.
Yeah,
she's doing a great job, and she's on the right track, and I hope we all the states and towns go that way.
Weather Debt and the Public Institute, publicbankinginstitute.org.
And we thank Woody for his segment, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Good night, folks.
Good night, everyone. And good night.